Okay, welcome back, everybody. Okay, it's the last year before Purim, and pretty much the whole series has been leading up to how we understand Megillat Esther in light of Purim. Just a little background. I like to compare Megillat Esther to a handwriting test. I'm not sure if you ever heard this story before. I'm not sure if it's true, but it's like a medrash that there was a group of 25 people who gave in their handwriting samples, and they got it back a day later with an analysis, like a one-page analysis of their handwriting. And they asked the people how good was the analysis, and they all said it was amazing, like right on the spot. And it turns out that everyone got the exact same analysis. No one analyzed anyone's handwriting. They just gave a blank analysis of a person's, you know, like something in psychology about people. And what happened was basically is that if you write something in a way that everyone can see themselves in it, you basically have a masterpiece. What am I getting at? I'm getting at what's so neat about Megillat Esther, no matter what your hashkafa is, you can find a proof to your hashkafa in Megillat Esther. Because you have people who study the book and find this is all about God, who is with Am Yisrael no matter where they are, in exile, in diaspora. God's always with you. You can always depend on him. It has nothing to do with the land of Israel. And you have people who say it's only about the land of Israel. So I'm not out to say who's right and who's wrong. I just want to show you how awesome the book is, because sometimes you think a book that can have so many interpretations is bad. I think the other way around. The book that has so many multiple interpretations is something really amazing about the author. So what we're going to do today is I'm going to take the Zionistic line because I live in Israel. And that's the from the title from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. It has to be something related to Zionism. And I'm going to, let me share my source sheet. And I have to begin with a quick review of what we've done till now. And a lot, I'd say maybe 20, 30% of the share today might be a review of something we've done before, but I want to frame it from a different angle today. So let's get started. Right now, okay, we have almost 100, so we should start. Here we go. Here's my source sheet. Okay, so let's review. What we talked about last week was who's the author and who's the audience. Why is that important? Every time you learn a book of Tanakh, you always have to ask yourself the question, what's the reason? I'm saying I'm missing a line here. No, this is the wrong class here. One second. Here we go, line 18. Okay, here we are. I'm sorry. So the last class, here's what we did. Who's the author? Who's the audience? And it's every time you read a book. So if it's the five books of Chumash, God's the author through Moshe Rabbeinu. Who's the audience? The Jewish people. That's easy. In the books of the prophets, you always have to ask yourself, not only which prophet wrote it, but who was the prophet's original audience? And in light of that, understand the book. And the second question is, why did the rabbis, why did Chazal canonize the book? In what way is its meaning meaningful for all generations? I spelled who's wrong here. You know, it's a typo there. Don't look at that. You have to erase that. Let's do a, sorry. We need to, okay. Okay, that's bad. Okay, now, the thing we talked about last week was, why isn't God's name mentioned? So I think we talked about a little bit. Part of the mention is like, you have to look for God, just like God is something, is not something we see, it's something we perceive. So we talked about how, if God's name isn't mentioned, it's not because he's not there. If the book is canonized, the author wants you to look for him. And the main thing we talked about last week was the time period of Megillat Esther. And we talked about the two opinions, the classic one in Chazal that puts Esther between Koresh and Daryavesh and before the temple was built, but of course after Koresh. And then we followed the historical opinion, which we're going to follow today, is that Ahasuerus is in the gap between Daryavesh and Artaxerxes, or basically in the gap between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. Last week we saw how and why if Megillat Esther is between Koresh and Daryavesh, how that explains all the Midrashim you learned when you were young. Today we'll understand how the more, I guess, Zionistic interpretation is going to relate to if Megillat Esther is between Daryavesh and Artaxerxes. We'll try to understand why each of those approaches go in different directions, but they share a common theme. So again, the last thing we did, we looked at the classic list of Persian kings. And if we followed outside history, then the best match for Ahasuerus is going to be Xerxes, because he's between Daryavesh and Ahasuerus. We know who Koresh is. Cambyses is never mentioned, but he's not king long enough to be. We need 14 years for Ahasuerus, and we don't have enough between 530 and 522. It's only 8 years. you have lots of time. If it's Xerxes, and for tons and tons of reasons, Xerxes is the best historical match. Why his name is Ahasuerus? In general, in Hebrew, we put an aleph before a name when you pronounce it. Anyone know what Plato's name is in Hebrew?
Aplaton.
Aplaton.
Lots of names. You add an aleph. In Hebrew, you add an aleph to a name to make it pronounceable in Hebrew. Last week, we brought the example of Lincoln, but Aplaton is even a better example. So the aleph is an add-on. There's a fancy name for it. And Hashrash, Xerxes, would match the name nicely. Okay, now we're going to get to work. That was just a review of what we did last week. I'm pretty sure that's a review. We talked about assumptions we're making when we said Megillat Esther, and I want to review these key assumptions to focus on what we're doing today. I could read Megillat Esther for information, meaning it's a history book, so I know what happened. The author is assuming the reader doesn't know the events, and I'm writing the events so the reader knows what happened. That's one way to look at it. But if I make a different assumption, that if I assume the reader knows the events, and I'm writing sort of a satire or a comment on the events, on those events, then the book is giving information, it's giving me an insight. I want to make sure that's clear. One key assumption, I'm assuming that when Megillat Esther was written, I don't think it was written to be canonized. And what's my proof? Its canonization was up for grabs, remember? And the Gemara talks about it. And one of the best proofs of that is, again, it's only by chance sort of, but in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found almost all the 24 books of Tanakh. The only book that there wasn't one copy of was Megillat Esther. Does that tell you something about the sect of the people living in Qumran? Or does that tell you something about the Second Temple period in Judea, that it wasn't a very popular book? You can argue either way. But listen to the difference, though. Assuming the book was written first and foremost for its own generation, was a book written to give that generation the story so they know what had happened? Or is the author assuming its readership knows the real story and it's rewriting the story in a sort of a fairy tale way to make a point? Then the question is what point they're making. And that affects how you read the book. Was Mordechai's name really Mordechai? Was Haman's name really Haman? Was he really an Agagite or not? Is that historical information for the reader to know? Or is the author assuming his reader knows other things and knows the real story and is rewriting the story to make a point? If that's the case, then what's the point? Now, so that's one way to look at the book's information, either the actual information or satire in that information. One thing we didn't discuss last week, which we'll discuss this week, it might be a book of halakha. Of course, not classic halakha, but rather, I need to know, I need sort of a psak that Purim is a holiday that everyone accepted and we have to celebrate the holiday. If that's the case, the whole book is building up to chapter 9. Because the main topic of the second half of chapter 9, which will be our main topic today, is that everyone accepted this holiday, the fact that it's accepted, not just for that generation, for all generations. It's not easy to establish a Jewish holiday. This is the first one that's being established ever. Hanukkah is much later. But to establish a new holiday, that's a big deal. And therefore, it could be the main purpose of the book is to teach the entire Jewish people that Purim is a celebration forever, and that's the reason for the book, and everything builds up to chapter 9. Or it could be, we talked about last week a little bit, maybe a book of philosophy or theology, where the goal of the book is to see the hand of God behind Jewish history. And even though I don't mention God's name, I'm purposely hiding God because the author wants the reader to find God through the coincidence of events. And the same thing the author wants the reader to do in reading the book is the same thing that we need to do in our day-to-day lives where God is not obvious and we have to see him through historical events. So that was the first point I wanted to make. Let me just do a quick little mute. Okay, and I think pretty much everyone's online is online. Now, who's the intended audience? So we talked about, is the intended audience the first generation or all future generations? And again, in addition to the question of why it's going to be canonized later on. But what's more important, which will be our topic today, not only who's the intended audience, what assumption is the author making about what the reader knows? Because if the book is more than just giving information, but the author wants the reader to reach some conclusion, if the book has a message and the message is not explicit, but rather implicit, once I'm assuming that God's behind the events. That means the message is implicit and not explicit. That should be clear. If it's canonized in Tanakh, that means the message is finding the hand of God behind history. But clearly the message is implicit and not explicit. So if the message of finding God is not explicit, but rather implicit, are there other messages that are implicit and not explicit? And then how does the author give over those messages? So if you're going to use a subtlety, or if you're going to use a satire to make a message, I have to make certain assumptions that the reader's aware of. So is the audience, is the readership, does the author think his audience is aware of the history in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, at least the first half of Ezra, up until that time period? Is he familiar with Chumash? Is he familiar with Nevim Rishonim, Nevim Achronim, with Yirmiyahu? Does he know Haggai and Zechariah, we'll see? Is his audience living in the exile or living in Israel? Is he aware of where the Jewish people are supposed to be? You know, basically, is he a Zionist or is he not a Zionist? And the main things we'll see today, is he aware of Haggai and Zechariah? Now, the final thing, which I guess is really key for today, is that the author have a sense of humor. Does he have a sense of humor? And does he expect his audience to have a sense of humor? Sometimes an author has his own sense of humor and is for himself is using humor, but sometimes he's assuming that his audience is going to catch on to his humor or to a satire. And that's another big question when I'm reading the book. Can I assume that the author is aware that or is expecting his readers to pick on the satire? And then the question, how do you define satire? If you want a really extensive book on the topic, Yoni Grossman has a big, thick book on Megillat Esther, called Megillat Esterim, I think it's called. It's in Hebrew. Is it translated in English? I'm pretty sure, maybe not. But it's very extensive on, he proves this whole idea of satire very nicely. Now, and then we talked about this many times, and that's going to be a key background for today's share, and then we can get started. And this is an important point to make. Behind every share, I'm going to do what's called objective analysis. In other words, if the author is intending for the reader to reach a conclusion based on textual parallels to earlier books in Chumash, there's objective analysis followed by subjective interpretation. Anyone listening to Rabbeinu's series on Tehillim, if you follow all the shiurim, what he does, the first thing he does is objective analysis. Oh, this word is only two times in Tehillim, and it's in this parak and that parak. Or he'll say, you know, this is a theme that repeats itself, or something like that. So the first half of the shiur will be some type of objective analysis. Afterwards, he'll give subjective interpretation, which that's what all the parshanim do. But it's important to understand the fact that a teacher or a parshan does a wonderful job of objective analysis, that doesn't always mean that a subjective interpretation is correct or unique. It could be there's multiple interpretations. Again, I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, but I love, you know, Benny Shulman are awesome, but you can take his charts and also reach different conclusions, as other parshanim do, and you can reach his conclusions. But whenever you study as a student, as a teacher, it's always important to differentiate between the first stage is the analysis, and secondly, what the interpretation is. But the interpretation has to be based on that analysis. How do you know it's right? I guess Am Yisrael decides, or the Beis Medrash decides. Now, to start our topic today, I'm going to work backwards. I'm going to talk about the end of Megillat Esther in chapter 9, and then go back to Haggai and Zechariah after we go through that. I want to talk about the two letters. I'm pretty sure we didn't talk about them yet. Correct me if I'm mistaken. I'm talking about the two letters at the end of the Megillah, which we don't pay too much attention to for two reasons. One is there's almost no more Hamans left. And when there's no more Hamans left, no one's paying attention. Two, at night we're fasting and we can't, you know, let's get it over with already. And we're not paying attention. And it's sort of, now once Haman is hung, and you know, it's pretty much all downhill from there. Just, you know, cleaning up the action. But at the end of the Megillah, Mordechai writes a letter. And when they institute a holiday, I want to show you how there's a big focus on instituting the holiday and how we celebrate it. So let's take a look. In chapter 9, verse 20, Perek Tet Pasachav, Mordechai writes these dvarim, and he sends books to all the, or his documents, this edict, to all the Jews in all the empire of Achashverosh, far, close and far away. What's the purpose of the letter? Lekayim. Remember the word lekayim? to enjoin or to establish, alem liot osim et yom arbasar l'chodesh adar, v'it chamishasar b'chol shana v'shana. To make sure, just like he celebrated on the 14th and 15th, 14th for the non-walled cities, 15th for the walled cities, or for Shushan, just like they celebrated, he wants everyone else to celebrate it. Corresponding to what? Kamim esher nechu lema yudim aveihem, on the days that we rested after the battle was over. And in what month? V'chol asher nepach lem yagon l'simcha u'me'evel li'yom tov, here's the key point. He's establishing these holidays. Number one, there's three basic things that we do on the holiday. It's a time of celebration, miyagon l'simcha, to make a mishte v'simcha. Secondly, mishloach monot ish l'reihu and matatot levyonim. Now, from what you remember, is there any other holiday? Let me just check the chat real fast. Is there any other holiday that has a mitzvah? One second, Edmund writes. Well, let me check. We talked about two letters before chapter 9. Okay, there's lots of letters. You're right. There's many letters in Megillat Esther. There's the edicts that Esther sends, that Haman sends out, the first letter and the second letter. And then there's lots of letters. These are the final two letters, but these are letters now to the Jews and not to the Persians. The earlier letters are for the Persian Empire in general. These two letters are for the Jewish people. So let's continue. Mishloach monot ish l'reihu, what's that mean? How many other holidays have a celebration, like Mishteh v'Simcha? We call Simchat Yom Tov? I'm pretty sure all of them. We call Sudat Yom Tov. Matatot Levyonim, if you know the idea of Simchat Yom Tov in the Rambam, in Hilchot Simchat Yom Tov, on every holiday, you're supposed to take care of the poor people. And I think, did we talk about in Nehemiah? I think we talked about Nehemiah. That's right. We mentioned that. In Nehemiah, when they make on we says, don't be so sad. It's Rosh Hashanah, the first day of the seventh month. It says, make sure to go home and celebrate and send manod le'in nachon lo, to send portions to people who don't have. But if I'm not mistaken, mishloach manod ish l're'ehu is unique to Purim. And if this is the main law that's unique to Purim, I would expect that law to have some connection to the theme of Purim. If I'm eating matzah on Passover, the special mitzvah of eating matzah on Passover relates to remembering the event. If I sit in a sukkah, remember, that God took care of us in the desert. Usually the special mitzvot we do on the holidays relate to the holiday itself or to the theme of holiday, in addition to the generic laws which make it any holiday a holiday. So having a festive meal, that's all holidays. Taking care of the poor people at that time and making sure they have, that's every Jewish holiday. But if we're looking for one thing that's unique about Purim, it's what's here in red, Mishloach Manot Ish L'Reihu. Now, it could be just something nice, or it could be something much deeper. And I want to suggest a reason, again, based on assuming that the audience knows the Book of Zechariah. Now, notice the eternal nature of the celebration. What happened? What's it say now? V'kibel ha'yudim asher yechilu asod et asher ketav Mordechai eliyam. And then we get the last Taman. We can skip all this. And here's what's really interesting. What does Purim mean? Purim means by chance, isn't it? A pur is a lot. It's the lottery. The lots that Achashverosh sent was a lottery. For some reason, we're calling the book by chance, which goes back to what we talked about last week. If the whole idea is find that nothing's by chance and God's behind the events, calling the holiday by chance, Al Shem HaPur, because it's just by chance it came out on that day. And not only the lottery came out by chance, but all the events came out by chance. So there's something almost ironic or maybe sarcastic that if the whole purpose is to find God's hand behind the events, calling the holiday by chance might not be by chance. Now we're going to highlight the fact that everyone's keeping the holiday. Kimu v'kiblu ha'yudim alem azaram betkon nivim baleam lo v'lavor liot osim et shemim ha'ilu v'chichtavam b'chol shana v'shana. What I'm trying to show you is the Megillah is highlighting over and over again, everyone's keeping it and everyone's doing it. And now finally, v'yimim eilu nizkrim v'nasim b'chol dor v'dor mishpacha mishpacha medina medina v'ir v'ir v'mipra milo yavru mitoch ha'yudim v'zicham l'yusuf mizaram ad k'chazal se'even imot ha'mashiach. All the other holidays might be abolished, but Purim will be there forever, which is really strange. To abolish the holidays, the Oraita, but keep this one, the Rabbanan, there must be something really special about it. If for some reason the book is emphasizing everyone's keeping this holiday forever and ever. Okay, now, so the question is, why the eternal celebration and why sending presents? So again, how we celebrate a party and poor people, that's generic. Sending presents, that's unique. Sending maternal ish l'reo is unique. And putting the accent forever and ever and ever and for all generations, especially when it's a Yeshua for a specific generation. So I'm assuming that even back then, people had questions about this celebration. And that's why we need a second letter. Is a second letter to make sure everyone accepts it or to explain the reason for the customs? I hope that question's clear. Esther and Mordechai are going to send a second letter. Do they need a second letter to give authority to make sure that everyone keeps it or to explain why we have to keep it? Now, it doesn't make sense that they're sending the letter to make sure everyone keeps it, because beforehand we pointed out over and over again that everyone's keeping it. It makes more sense to send a letter to explain why we have to keep it forever and why it's and what are the laws of Purim. Let's read what happens in the second letter. It's only three lines. Pasuk Chaptet. Vatichtov Esther Malkah v'bat Yibcha Mordechai Yehudi et kol tokev l'chaim b'tigeret haPurim hazot hashanit. So Mordechai and Esther are writing with full authority to keep the second letter. Now we saw in our study of Nehemiah, remember when Nehemiah travels, he gets igarets from the king? An igaret is more than just a letter. An igaret is already like an official decree. But this is not an igaret for the entire Persian people. This is an igaret for the Jewish people. But this is some type of letter with some type of authority sent to the Jewish people. And now we have to explain what's in the letter and what's the purpose of the letter. Pasuk Lamed will see what's in the letter, and Pasuk Lamed Aleph will be the purpose of the letter. So let's jump to Lamed Aleph. The purpose of the letter is the reason we're sending the letter, again, is to confirm, or he said before, to enjoin, to make sure that these days are kept. But that doesn't explain what's the content of the letter. The content of the letter, again, Lamed Aleph is the purpose of the letter. Lamed is the content of the letter. What's in the letter? Let's read Lamed now. Vayishlach svarim l'kol yehudim el sheva v'asim u'mei medina, malchut achashverosh, divrei shalom v'emet. That's not the introduction to the letter. That's the content of the letter. And the question is, what does divrei shalom v'emet mean? Now, it could just mean shalom aleichem, how are you doing? And peace be with you. But it's really strange that this is the only thing that's being described that's what's in the letter. There must be a need for a second letter, otherwise it wouldn't be sent. And the need for the letter, we see in Lamed Aleph, is to make sure that we keep the holiday the way Mordechai and Esther established the holiday, which was what? Which was the three things, making Mishteh v'Simcha, Mishloach Menot Yisrael Matot Levyonim. So it would make sense that the second letter is coming to explain the reason for the first letter, the reason for the customs of the first letter. Not just the authority, but the reason for it. So what I have to do in the shir now is see if I can find some connection between Mishloach Menot Ish L'Rehu and Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Now, to do that, let's continue, go back to Pasuk Lamed Aleph. There's another important detail here. The reason we're sending the letters and the reason we're giving this information of Divrei Shalom Ve'emet is to make sure that the people keep pouring the way Mordechai and Esther said to keep it, which again, Yimei Mishteh V'Simcha, Me'evel Yom Tov, with Mishloach Monot Yisrael Matot Le'odim. And the last phrase is really interesting. That's why it's in green. V'kasher kibo nafsham v'alzaram, divrei atzmaot v'zakatam. Just like the Jews took upon themselves and their offspring. That's not on themselves and their children. It means on themselves and future generations. On nafsham v'alzaram means for all generations. This is an eternal celebration. What's being pointed out here, this is an eternal celebration, not just for one generation, but for all generations. This is pointing out the eternal side of it. The words or the laws of the fast days and crying out. What are divrei atzmaot v'zakatam? Some parshanim claim this is Tanit Esther, But it can't be our Tanit Esther. It can't be Tanit Esther of the 13th of Adar, because the custom of fasting on the 13th of Adar, what we call Tanit Esther, is relatively new. It's only about 800-900 years old. It started in time of the Rishonim. It's not in the Gemara. It's not in the Mishnah. No, it's not. I don't think it's even in the Gaonim. Our custom of fasting on Tanit Esther is relatively new. Why? Ask your local rabbi. It could be referring to Esther's Tanit, which was that three-day Tanit before she went to Ahasuerus' palace. But that wasn't a fast for all generations. That was, everyone at that time kept it. In fact, that took place on Chol Hamoed Pesach, if I follow the dates. So it makes more sense. It's not referring to Tanit Esther, what we call Tanit Esther, the one in Megillat Esther or the one in that we keep today. But rather, it's earlier Divrei Tzomah V'Sakatam, and the best candidate, in fact, the only candidate, is going to be the fast days to remember Yerushalayim. And if you know your Zecharia, the answer will be easy. So what I want to suggest, in fact, I'm going to follow the Ebenezer in a minute, that Mordechai and Esther are referring to the fast days for Yerushalayim, and hence they're assuming that the people receiving this letter know Zecharia. And that's the anchor of my share. So again, is Divrei Shalom Vemet, is it the introduction or is it the content? I proved it's the content of the letter. What's the connection to the fast days? So let's look, listen to what Ebenezer says. What's the meaning of Tam Divrei Atzmo V'Zakatam? I just skipped. He dismisses that it's talking about our Tanis Esther or Esther's Tanis, you know, in the beginning of the book. But what's it referring to? Ala Nizkarim B'Sefer Zecharia. It's the fast days that Zecharia is talking about in chapter 7 and 8, which we'll get to soon. Shein Tammuz Ba'av V'Tishrei V'Tevet. The four fast days, Shifas Tammuz, Tisha B'Av, Tzum Gedalia, and Asar B'Tevet. Listen carefully. V'Hatam Ki Kimu HaYudim Anafsham Lismoach B'Mei Purim. The Jews took upon themselves, accepted this custom for everybody. We accepted a minhag that everyone's keeping now for all generations to be happy on these days of Purim. Kasher kimo nafsham be'azaram ditanot b'mei avlam. Just like everyone accepted a custom to fast to remember the destruction of Jerusalem, now everyone's taking upon themselves to feast to remember the victory of Purim. In other words, we're turning, just like we accepted fast days, we're accepting now feast days. Now, at the simplest level, it's explaining under what authority can a rabbi or any generation make a new Jewish custom. Because if you read the Bible, you're not allowed to add. Remember in chapter 4 in the book of Devarim, second line, it says, these are the laws you have to keep. You're not allowed to add. You can't add. Lo tosif, lo tigru mimeno. The rabbis get around that with no problem, don't they? That's one thing that they're not so machmir on. Or not so machmir on. The Torah says, you know, you can't add laws and you can't take off laws, but what we do, we don't add. We sort of protect the existing ones. But that's for a different discussion. But basically, up until this point, there are no other rabbinic holidays. How can you establish a rabbinic holiday? So what's the precedent? We established rabbinic fast days and it caught on. So Ebenezer is saying, just like everyone accepted, and under, I guess, the authority of Klal Yisrael or some Beit Din, everyone accepted to fast to remember Jerusalem. Now we're going to feast to remember the victory of Purim. Okay, so that's what Ebenezer says. That's the simplest understanding. But if I look at, if the second letter, again, is alluding to something deeper, then I have to go to Zecharia where he talks about the four fast days, because the only time in Tanakh that I'm going to find four fast days and Divrei Shalom Vemet is going to be in the book of Zecharia. I'll jump to it in a minute. But we're going to see, let me just run right to the pasuk. I'll go ahead down. In the book of Zecharia, what are we going to find? We're going to go back to this if we want to get the background. But what does Zecharia say? Kol Mar Hashem, the four fast days, Tzom Arvi, Tzom HaChamishi, V'Tzom HaShvi, V'Tzom HaSiri, Yeh LeBeit Yehuda LaSason LeSimcha LeMo'adim Tovim, Vemet V'Shalom Mahavu. What Zecharia is going to say, we're going to get to how and why he says it. But ultimately, Zecharia is going to say the four fast days are going to become holidays if you keep Emet V'Shalom. So what do we find? I find fast days turning into feast days. I find, I'm referring to the fast days themselves to remember Jerusalem and the idea of Emet V'Shalom. And the only other time I have these fast days and Emet V'Shalom together is in the end of Megillat Esther. Again, it could be coincidental. If it's not coincidental, then my assumption is that Esther, not just the author of Megillat Esther, but Esther and Mordechai themselves are assuming that the recipients of the letter are aware of Zechariah's Nevuah. Got that? That's my key points. I want to just say it again. The phrase Divrei Shalom Vemet with fast days is only in Megillat Esther and Zechariah. Therefore, the question is it safe to assume that when Esther sends out the second letter with Divrei Shalom Vemet and relates it to the four fast days to remember Jerusalem, is Esther and Mordechai, are they assuming that the people receiving the letter, which are all the Jews throughout the Persian Empire, are they aware of Nevuot Zechariah? Now, why do we spend so much time in identifying the time period of Megillat Esther and all the previous shiurim? Because, let's go back to what we saw before. The main point I was trying to make in the introductions, okay, go way, way back up, when where's if Achashverosh is between Koresh and Daryavesh, where Chazal put him, then the temple was not rebuilt yet. We're not during the reign of Daryavesh yet, and therefore we're before Haggai and Zechariah. But if Achashverosh is here between Daryavesh and Artaxasta, then the story of Purim and hence Megillat Esther is taking place during the reign of Achashverosh, which is immediately after Daryavesh. And the letter that Esther's sending out is about 30 years after Zechariah's Nevuah, which means it's a Nevuah that the people should be familiar with. And more than that, we're going to see, it was a Nevuah, this letter in chapter 7 and 8, it's not just a Nevuah of Zechariah, it's the last message of God to the Jewish people. It's one of the key messages. There's only two messages to the diaspora, one of Yirmiyahu, and you know, at the time of when the first temple was being destroyed, and now this one of Zechariah, and it's the last dated Nevuah in the Bible. It's the most recent, but it's also the final one. And the question is, can I assume that Am Yisrael is aware of Zechariah? And is Mordechai and Esther assuming that the people receiving the letter are aware of this Nevuah? And if so, it's going to change how we understand how and why we celebrate Purim. Okay. Now, to do that now, I have to go to the background of the letter of Zechariah's Nevuah in chapter 7 and 8. So to do that, we have to review everything we did this year. Remember, from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. So let's start with King Cyrus. We did this year already way, way back in the beginning. Just a quick review. The first year of Koresh, remember, just like Yirmiyahu had predicted, the Babylonians fall. After 7 years, their empire, after 7 years of Babylonian sovereignty in the Middle East, their empire falls to the Persians. And just by chance, the Persian king, Koresh, on his own for political reasons, decides to allow all the ethnic groups to go back and return to their homelands, including the Jewish people. The prophets say this is not just Koresh, God's behind those events. That's here, Hashemet Ruach Koresh. And we saw all the proofs of that from what we call from Yishayahu Perek Mem. Yeah, especially Perek Mem Dalet Mem Hey, where Yishayahu says, that's not Koresh, that's God. I sent Koresh, and I'm predicting the events, and I'm coming to fulfill the revolt of Yirmiyahu. And then anyone who doesn't go to Jerusalem, all the Jews in the empire can go to Yerushalayim and build a house for God. Anyone who doesn't go can send money. Now, we mentioned this briefly, now we want to talk about more clearly. What did Achashverosh do? What did Koresh do? Vamelech Koresh hotzi et klei beit Hashem asher hotzi Nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim beit Nim b'yad Elohav v'yotzim Koresh melech paras ay demitridat ha-gizbar v'isperim l'shesh patsar nesi l'Yehuda. Not only did Koresh allow the Jews to return, he went into his treasury and he took the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar had stolen from the Beit HaMikdash or pillaged from the Beit HaMikdash and kept in his own palace. When Koresh took over the Babylonian Empire, he now took possession of those first vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, and he gave them, in fact, he counted them, to the Jews who were returning. Which means already in the time of Koresh, the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash are back. Now, we have a beautiful custom when we read Megillat Esther, when we say, V'kelim mikelim shonim, we're saying that the author of Megillat Esther is alluding to the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash. So the classic Midrash is, why were we almost punished? Now, why were we almost annihilated? Because we participated in that party that Achashverosh threw for 180 days, and in that party, we drank from vessels that were used from the Beit HaMikdash. The problem is, the vessel of the Beit HaMikdash returned already. The bigger problem is, Mordechai and Achashverosh is wealthy enough, he doesn't need to borrow kelim that are over 100 years old to entertain his party for 180 days. But rather, it seems like if the Megillah is alluding to these kelim, it's alluding to the fact that the Jews might have forgotten their opportunity to return, as we'll see soon. So that was just one example. Now, but Ezra, in the book of Ezra, he alludes to the Nebuah of Yirmiyahu in 7 years of Yirmiyahu. What did Yirmiyahu say was going to happen after 70 years? What did Yirmiyahu say? He didn't say after 7 years you're coming back. He says, after 7 years, I'm going to keep my promise that the Babylonians will fall and you have a chance to return, but it's a two-way street. What do you need to do? After the Babylonians fall and someone else takes over, Ukrata motiv alachtem, you have to call to me and come. Pray to me and I'll hear your prayers. Search for me. Ubikashta motiv mitzatem, kidu shun b'chol levavchem, v'nimseti etchem nu mashem, and b'shavti et shvutchem, v'kibatzi b'chol agoyim, b'chol makomot, asho idachte etchem sham, v'ashivyot etchem alam kom hazeh. In a nutshell, Yirmiyahu is saying, not that after 7 years you're automatically coming back. After 7 years, the Babylonians will fall and receive their punishment for what they've done wrong. Someone else will take over. You'll have the opportunity to return, but you need to want to return. So God isn't saying there will be redemption, there can be redemption after 7 years, but it's a two-way street. The small group returns under during Koresh's reign, and after 2 years we studied. We had that building freeze and everyone's down and depressed. And we talked about before Hanukkah time, Haggai and Zechariah in the second year of Dayavesh are encouraging the people, don't give up hope. There's a new administration in Babylonia, in Persia. Dayavesh, he's a great king. He's allowing us to build. Don't give up hope and get started. And sure enough, they take the rebuke and they take the challenge. And in, on the 24th of Kislev, they break ground on the temple in the second year of Dayavesh. And then we learned that it was finished in the sixth year of Dayavesh. So it took 4 years to build. But all the big impetus to build is in year two of Dayavesh. All of Haggai's in year two of Dayavesh, promising return to prosperity, return to sovereignty. And the famous line we quote in Shmoneh Esrei every day from Zechariah, "Lachin kom Hashem shafti Yushan barachamim biti yibaneba." That's Yushan b'cha barachamim tashuv. "V'tishkom batocha kasher ibarte uvnei uta b'kar b'yamin b'inan olam." All based kasher ibarte is referring to this famous Nebuah of Zechariah in chapters 1 and 2. The Shechina returning, Rani v'simchi batzion, v'shachanti betoch, v'shachanti betochech, meaning year two of Zechariah, year two of Dayavesh is full of great hope and prophetic vision. The second temple, if I quote from Haggai, the second temple can be greater than the first temple. I think we saw that earlier. But what if Haggai, we'll see Haggai in a minute here. Haggai's right here. G'doy yekvod abayit zachron min arishon. Jerusalem can be great again. The second temple period can be greater than the first temple period. Just, you have to follow me and take advantage of the opportunity I'm giving you. Then, we continued that study and showed how, even though they built the temple, everything fizzled out. And that gap between Ezra's return, some 30, 40 years later, in chapter 7 of Ezra, proved that after year 6 of Dayavesh, after they finished building, the people didn't answer the call. And all those big hopes were far from fulfilled. Now, Ibn Ezra mentioned that that letter in the book of, in chapter 9, in Megillat Esther, is referring to the Nebuah of Zechariah in chapter 7 and 8. What was that story? We discussed this on Asar B'Tevet. I'll just review it. In year 4 of Dayavesh, which is during the middle of the construction, it's halfway built. You know, it's 2 years since we broke ground, a year or two before they finish. There's a delegation from Babylonia in the fourth year of Dayavesh. There's a delegation being sent to the house of God. Saretz and Regemelef and Oshav, almost all the Parshim say these are people from Babylonia coming to ask God and asking the Kohanim and the prophets in the Beit HaMikdash, do we continue fasting on Tisha B'Av like we've been doing for many years? Why? Because they've been fasting to remember that the temple was destroyed. And they want to know if the temple is being rebuilt, is there any reason to continue fasting? Remember, God answered them, I didn't ask you to fast. You decided to fast. You decide when you eat. And basically, you took upon yourself to fast. That's up to you. But if you're asking God, what is it that God wants you to do? That's our big topic now. What does he say? God wants you to do the things when that caused Jerusalem to be destroyed, had you only listened to the earlier Nevi'im, which we show were Yirmiyahu and Yeshayahu, who warned the temple will be destroyed if you don't fix your society, had you listened to them, the temple would not have been destroyed. Now it's being rebuilt. Are you asking, is this redemption? So it's up to you. And let me give you an analogy, which I thought of this morning on the news. On the news, every morning, the interview, I'll stop the share for a minute, take a break from the screen. On the news this morning, probably in America also, Israel went out of a lockdown today, a partial, like, where basically stores opened up again and things like that. So the guy in charge of the whole corona thing, this Professor Ash, they asked him, do you think, will there be another lockdown? You know, are the numbers going to go up or down? He said, what's going to be? You know, what to get ready for? His answer was exactly as Zacharias. He says, don't ask me, ask yourselves. It's up to you. Will there be another lockdown? Depends. Are you going to wear masks? Are you going to keep your social distancing? Are you going to make, you know, if you follow the rules, you can prevent that from happening. There's what will be, don't ask the experts what will be. They'll tell you what can be. Okay? There can be a recovery or there can be a wider epidemic. It's up to you. And therefore, what do you need to do to make sure that things go back to normal? It's almost the exact same thing. If I hope you understand my analogy. I'm sure you have the same thing wherever you're living. Everyone wants to know what's going to be. It's not up to the experts. It's up to the people. The experts give guidance how the people have to behave. But the fate of what will happen is in the hands of the people. And everyone's involved in it. It's not one person. Everyone has to be in that together and follow the rules. So if I go back now to my screen share, what are we up to? What happened? So keep, and in case the people forgot, listen, but remember, we did all this. What did God say? Mishpatim et shvotu v'chesed brachim asu ishat achiv. Make sure to do truth and justice and take care of the poor and the needy, the orphan, the widow, and don't think bad about your fellow man. And then Zacharias said, I'm returning, I'm bringing my Shekhinah back to Yerushalayim. Jerusalem needs to be called a city of truth, but again, that's up to you. And remember, the city will be filled with old people with their canes sitting on benches and little kids playing in the streets. And now come the Zionist part. Komar Hashem in chapter 8, verse 7. Hinim Moshiach Tami Meretz Mizrach Meretz Mevo Hashemesh. I'm redeeming my people now from all corners of the globe, from the east and from the west. Everyone can come back. I'm bringing them back, and they can dwell inside Yerushalayim. They'll be my people. I'll be their God. It's the theme of the brief from Har Sinai. That's the brief from Sefer Bereshit as well. It's a key theme of the Bible that we're God's people in a land representing God as a sovereign nation in the land. But on what condition will this work? If you do, emet and staka. And then he continues the Navi and says, just like I went out of my way, I plotted to bring you down when you got me angry. Okay. Now I'm playing with historical events to be good to Yerushalayim, don't be afraid. Meaning your ability now to return to Jerusalem and build a temple, that's from God. Take advantage of it. It's up to you. But it's not enough to make Aliyah and live in Jerusalem and build a temple, but you have to also build a society. Now listen carefully. Listen, this is the best line. That's why it's in green. If the people ask Zechariah, what do we need to do? Do we need to fast or don't we need to fast? Zechariah says, don't worry about fasting. Here's what you need to do. Not just return, but when you return or wherever you are, be a nation that sanctifies God in their day-to-day life. Dabru emet ishet re'eu. See the phrase ishet re'eu? Emet mishpat shalom shiftu b'sharechem. That's it. Two lines of what you need to do. Bottom line. He said it in the introduction. He says it over again. The main thing you need to do is speak emet, speak truthfully, do mishpat, and live with shalom with one another, and think nicely about one another. Ishet re'eu. Over and over again, right? Dabru emet ishet re'eu in Pasuk Tetzayin. Pasuk Tetzayin, ishet re'eu atachshu b'avchem. Do good things and don't think bad things. Doing bad. And that's because those are the things that God wants, and not doing that is what God hates. And then in light of that, God says, here's the answer about fasting. You know what? Those fast days, you decided. But if you do right, your fast days can become holidays. If what? The four fast days, Soma Arvi, Soma Chamishi, Megat Esther is referring to this nevuah, okay? They'll turn into holidays. So Sason, they'll be, instead of fast days, they'll be Sason v'simcha in Modim Tomim. On what condition? A summary of everything emet v'shalom ahavu. And what do we find? The four fast days that Am Yisrael took upon themselves to keep and have accepted. And now Zechariah says, if you want redemption to be complete, you have to do emet v'shalom. and build a nation of them. So again, this might be again an amazing coincidence, but if, since this is a letter sent, this is an answer by God to the question of the exiles, do we continue fasting or not? It makes sense that Esther and Mordechai assume people are aware of this nevuah because it's maybe 20, 30 years old. And it's the last nevuah and it's an important one. And it might explain why we were almost destroyed. But if God saved us, there's a reason why we're saved. Again, if the readers are aware, not just of Zechariah, of the theme of Chumash, that God chose a nation to serve him forever, and God set aside a land for us to live in. He wants us to be a sovereign nation, and we sanctify God how we live as a people. So if that's the final message of Nevi'im, remember, in Zechariah say, don't need new Nevi'im, just follow what the old Nevi'im said, and Zechariah is simply echoing the messages of Yirmiyahu and earlier of Yeshayahu, in fact, all the classic later prophets, then it could be that the explanation that Mordechai and Esther is giving is not under what authority you have to keep these laws, but what's the reason for the strange laws of Purim. And hence, Mishloach Monach Ish L'Re'ehu is basically a reminder to fulfill Zechariah, to study Zechariah Zayin Chet, which is what God expects you to do, not just to return to Israel and build a temple, but to be a nation worthy of having a temple, and to make sure not to repeat the same mistakes of the first temple period. So should God give you another opportunity, it's not enough just to return to make Aliyah and build a temple, but rather how you have to behave to be worthy of returning or to be worthy of Mikdash once you return. And then if I review, can our key phrases, remember, Emet Mishpat Shalom and Ishat Re'eh, we saw, and the fast days becoming holidays. And then I just have a little table here in case you want to see it nice and clear. I guess it's clear. Take a look here. We'll make it smaller so we can see it. Here we go. We'll make it real small. Okay. So I have a little table here. You can print this out later on. But I took, this is Zechariah chapter 8 on this side, chapter 9 in Esther on this side, and all the things that are parallel, the four fast days. Soson Simcha, as opposed to Yime Yom Tov, Yogon Simcha Nevel Yom Tov, Vishtev Simcha. Ish L'Re'ehu, we have Ish L'Re'ehu here, Ish L'Re'ehu here, and Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, and Emet Mishpat Shalom Shvotu. You see them on both sides. I think it's pretty, in my opinion, it's pretty convincing. Again, it could be like the whole Megillah, it could be by chance, and maybe that's why the book is called By Chance Purim, or it could be, again, that's why that methodology was so important. Can I assume that Esther Mordechai, or the authors of Megillat Esther, assume that the people receiving the letter know Zechariah, and hence the customs of Purim, why is this an eternal holiday? There's no doubt Zechariah's message is an eternal message, isn't it? Zechariah's message is the most eternal message about God telling the people, don't give up hope. There's always a chance of redemption, no matter how bad you are. God will never forsake his people forever. It goes back to Shirat Hazinu. For sure, he'll never forsake you, and no matter how bad you are, you might get punished harshly, but I'll save you ultimately. But there's a long-term purpose in your becoming a people and returning to your land and building a temple. And it's not just building the temple and returning, it's what type of society that you build. And if I need to remember that, if that's our eternal goal as a people, then I can remember that eternally. And if I'm going to establish a holiday to remember that God saved us, even though we might not have been deserving, but he saved us anyhow, so that we'll be ready for another chance, it could be that Mishloach Monach Ish L'Re'ehu was established in order to remember Zechariah's message. Now, if you never studied Zechariah in your life, you'd never catch on to that, right? Just like another little line. If you know your Zechariah, it might be a little convincing. If the whole purpose of the law was to remind the people of Zechariah, and that was Esther's intention, then that's got to be the most important mitzvah of Purim. Now, I guess maybe the icing on the cake, if I continue reading, this we think we talked about when we did this, is that Zechariah says not only are you going to return to your land, when the fasts have become holidays, but when things go good, that there'll still be a time when not only will you be a people, but other nations will come and try and learn from you. You'll become a light to other nations. And what will happen? People from all around will call. People will say, we all want to go the Chalot Pnei Hashem. And what was so ironic about it was that the delegation from Babylonia came L'chalot et Pnei Hashem to ask about fasting. And now we're saying non-Jews will come once Am Yisrael is in Jerusalem, living a life of chesed and shalom v'emet, and serving God properly in the temple, other nations will come to visit Jerusalem to be inspired by our people. Again, all peoples or many nations will come in search of God in Yerushalayim. And then the final line, like the grand finale of this whole unit in Zechariah, is Kol Hashem Tzvot. On that day, so it's when non-Jews are coming to Jerusalem to find God, it'll be so crowded, there'll be 10 people waiting in line, nations, and they'll be sort of holding on to the edge of an Ish Yehudi, in the corner of a garment of an Ish Yehudi, saying, I want to follow you. We heard God's with you. We want to be inspired by you. And of course, I think this we mentioned, that Ish Yehudi is only two times in Tanakh. And then if I take the famous opening line in Perek Bet, where I introduce Mordechai, our hero, an Ish Yehudi who should be in Yerushalayim HaBira, instead in Shushan HaBira, I think I showed you in Divrei Hayamim, the word Bira is used exclusively for the Beit HaMikdash. Instead of, no, and that's, we're talking about 15, 20 years later, and instead of Am Yisrael fulfilling this Ish Yehudi who could be in Yerushalayim, instead our Ish Yehudi is in Shushan HaBira. And of all names, his name is the chief Babylonian god who gets all the credit for the Cyrus Declaration. If you read the Cyrus Declaration, remember, King Cyrus attributes everything to Marduk, the Babylonian god who was upset with the Babylonians for being so corrupt. And he opened up the gates of Babylonia to the Persians because he's so angry with his people. And then the Persians adopt this Babylonian god Marduk and praise him as well. And Cyrus gives him all the credit. But hence, we want all the people to serve their God. And then, for some reason, now he is our hero named Mordechai. Remember, no one invited Rishon to say Mordechai other than Babylonian kings. Remember, Abel Merodach and Merodach Baladan, etc. But why do we go back four generations? We go back to his grandfather and Zadie and grandzadie were all Jewish names. Ben Yair, Ben Shimei, Mekish, Ishimini. But why do I go back to Galut Yerushalayim? And again, for four generations, it's perfect time-wise. It's four generations since Galut of Yehoyachin. That's exactly Yirmiyahu chapter 29, who sends a letter after that Galut. Was Yirmiyahu's letter. Let me just go back real fast to prove that. We have 5 minutes left. Let me just go back. If you remember, where's my Tanakh? If I go back to Yirmiyahu chapter 29, the famous letter that Jeremiah sent, we read from verse 10 about the 70 years, what to do when they're over. But these are the words, this is the book that Yirmiyahu sent to the Zikni HaGola. This is the official letter of the Gola and the Kohanim and the Nevim. All the people, Asher Oglan Nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim Bavela, Acharei Tzot Yochin HaMelech VaGvira VaSisim Sar Yehuda VaAcharei Shvan Yerushalayim. That's what Notes, our yichus of Mordechai goes to this event. Asher glav Yerushalayim im glav asher glatai im nevechnetzar melech bavel of galut yachonia. And kol marshem, which said kol gala, asher glati, member b'nu vatim b'shevu, settle down in Bavel and get married, and settle that way, because it's going to take another 70 years. That's what we read before. It'll be another 70 years until I remember you to bring you back, but you have to call out to me. That's all we read before. So, if the two main letters that the exile gets is from Yirmiyahu, the original one from Yirmiyahu, to settle down until the 70 years are over. And when the 70 years are over of Zechariah, it's time to return and build a just society. It's pretty amazing that those are exactly what Miguel Tester might be alluding to. Again, assuming that the author of the book is assuming that the readers of the book know their Tanakh and their Chumash, especially Yirmiyahu and Zechariah. Now, if that's the case, then we can suggest a couple other things about Megillat Esther, and then I'll take questions just quickly. I think we mentioned, who's the king? Remember, some people say in Chazal that every melech might be referring to God in a hidden way. So when Haman says to the king, Haman's saying what he thinks, but is the Megillah alluding to something deeper? Yeshno am echad mufuzam frad ben hamim. That's Haman talking, but is that God talking in a subtle way? There's a nation scattered among the nations, but is that God explaining why Am Yisrael might deserve to be destroyed, as the Gaon Megillah talks about? Why was Am Yisrael almost deserving to be destroyed? Baruch Hashem, we were saved. But you have to understand that we could have been destroyed, and there had to be a reason why God was angry with us. Maybe God was angry because we were scattered instead of being united, and we didn't go back when we had a chance. That's maybe a little too Zionistic, but it might be a hidden message in the book. But if you look at that idea, remember the Nevi'im, compare Am Yisrael to, like, especially Hosea, Yirmiyahu for sure, like the later Nevi'im, compare the connection between God and the Jewish people with a husband and wife relationship. For sure, you have it in Hosea, you have it in Yechezkel, but in a negative way, where Isha, Isha that's cheating on her husband, but God will take us back anyhow. But it's interesting that the first story in the Megillah, where the king is having a party for all the nations, he wants to show off his greatness to all the nations. He calls his wife to show off her beauty to make himself look great, and his wife doesn't want to come back. Now, you can argue, was it the right thing or the wrong thing? But it could be that story of calling Vashti to show off her beauty might be parallel to God calling upon his people to show off his greatness, and God being angry because the king being angry because his wife doesn't want to make her husband look good. Again, that might be just cuter by coincidence. But the main thing we saw before, we talked about the calling Shushan the Bira, going back to Divrei Yamim, and the Kidlim Mikidlim Shonim, the description of the party. Not to mention, what we didn't talk about at all, is describing things in the party and the clothing in the party, like the Big Day Kuna and Achashverosh's palace. There's a Chatzer Pnimit and a Chatzer Chitzona, and Esther being able to go in, but without being called in. It's almost like a Yom Kippur. If you don't go in the right way, you're Chayv Mita like the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur and things like that. Those are allusions. Are they exact or not? You can argue, but they might be alluding to something. Now, someone mentioned this first letter. So Mamuchin says, you know what? This is setting a precedent. If Vashti gets away with what she did, what will everyone else think? I think this is the main parallel. Where what? What's the whole theory? If Vashti doesn't listen to the king, no one will listen to the king. Meaning, if God's own people don't listen to their God, what do you want from other nations? If the one and only God calls his own special people to return and they don't answer the call, how do you expect other nations to learn from that? And therefore, something's got to be done about it. It can't go unnoticed. And what's the final verdict? What's the reason? What's the final sefer that they write that someone mentioned beforehand? The what? Is that hinting to where we're supposed to be? No, every nation has to be where he belongs, in his own home, and speak his own language. And as opposed to Am Yisrael, which is Mufuzan Farad Ben Amim, and not speaking, almost living among the Persians. So that might be another illusion. Again, all these things are just conjecture. But it could be, again, everything by chance, or it could be there's something deeper there. If you want, on the source sheet, I put some more parallels between Zecharia and Megillat Esther about Hadassim and about Ketzef Adchem Ketzef. There's more, not as strong as the ones I've shown you, but they can, what's called Chazedit Strufe, they might be able to add on. So I know I have to finish up because Dr. Berman's coming on in a minute. Let me check the chat real fast. And do Jews in Israel have to observe Purim? Okay. Halacha questions about, basically, you don't reach halacha conclusions based on the shir. You can get thematic conclusions. Let's say you're not getting, could you make life decisions based on the study of Megillat Esther? That's one thing, but how to celebrate Esther halachically, ask your local rabbi. As far as the reversal of Emet for Shalom, and many times, Tzedek v'Mishpat, Mishpat v'Tzedakah, there's key words going back and forth, Chesed v'Emet, Emet v'Chesed, those happens a lot in Tanakh. I don't think it's, remember, honoring your mother and father and mother. I think they go back and forth a lot. We don't know who the author of the Megillah is. I'm talking about what the author is assuming. I'm not sure if the book was written in exile or in land of Israel. And I'm not sure if the author really had a sense of humor or believed in satire. But if you know your time periods, if I'm not mistaken, Greek satire begins pretty much the same time period, about 4th, 5th century BCE. So pretty much the same time period as the composition of Megillat Esther is the beginning of Greek using satire to get their points across. And thanks for it. Okay, follow. The other person comes to Ishtar. Some people say Esther is cool. Is Esther Ishtar? Is it purposely, the fact that Esther doesn't say who she is. We don't know why Mordechai tells Esther not to say who she is. Mordechai doesn't know what's going to happen 8 years, six, 7 years later about Haman. That all happens later on. And is Mordechai assimilated Jew telling and hiding his identity because he's a big shot in the foreign government? Is Mordechai endangering the entire Jewish people because his political knows? Is that a person with political ambitions endangering the entire Jewish people because of his political ambitions? That might be true. I don't want to bring examples from Israeli politics, but some people say that Mordechai does just like Esther goes through a sort of renewal and finds herself in the book. So does Mordechai, and finds God. Or was Mordechai a tzaddik, all the way along, or only in the middle does he realize his nation? And was he hiding his identity as well? But that's a big question. The question: when does Haman find out that he's Jewish? Only when he's looking some way to kill him. Or did he know he's Jewish all along? And why doesn't Mordechai bow down? Medin knows I'm more important than he is, or Medin of Adazara. Look in the commentators, you'll have a whole range of opinions. And then Esther's name, is that because of Ishtar or because of Anochi Esther, Esther Panamikem? Is it Meloshin Hester or Ishtar? I think it's great wordplay. And there's tons of things in Megillah with double meaning. If you know, I heard a lecture, forgot when, where he showed someone who's an expert in ancient Persian showing all the wordplay in the Megillah. There's tons of wordplay like Vashti, or her name in Persian means something that relates to what happened to her. Almost every single name, every Persian word, there's something cute about it. So that was interesting. And Haman wrote, Shmuel wrote, if he didn't bow down because Haman wore an idol around his neck. That's the Midrash giving, making Mordechai into Baruch Mordechai, into a firm guy. But that's an understandable pirush. Now, let me explain one last word, because I know I have to finish in 2 minutes. I don't want to interrupt on Josh's share. But I get in trouble for saying this, but it's okay. Esther is a famous book because the holiday is about, we bring together Esther, all kids learn about it in Gan. Purim happens during the school year, doesn't it? So all school children know about Megillat Esther. And just listen to your grandchildren, little kids, 5 years, 4 or 5 year olds, telling the story of Esther and how Ganenets have to take a story which is not age appropriate for children at all and turning it into an age appropriate story. So because it's such a famous story, I need to make it child friendly. I need to make it firm friendly, meaning I have to make Mordechai a tzaddik, don't I? I have to make Esther a tzaddikess. Don't be surprised that that's what the Medrash does, and that's totally legitimate and correct. That doesn't mean it's historically true, but there's an historical necessity because of the holiday of Purim, because of our custom to read Megillat Esther in public, and it becomes part of Jewish education. I can't teach this to a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. And I can't teach what I did to people who don't know their Tanakh. Because it's like, no one knows. If you don't know your Zechariah, if we didn't do that whole course we did this year, and just like a regular yeshiva bacher, no one knows. You don't know what I'm talking about. Again, if you're not aware of the Cyrus Declaration and Ezra and Nehemiah and Yirmiyahu and stuff like that, in the time period, all this stuff is way over anyone's head. If you're aware of it, I think it takes on deep meaning. So that's my question. That was my whole point. When I study Megillat Esther, can I assume that the author and its audience, the author is aware, and he assumes that his audience is aware of Zechariah, and that was the title, Reading Megillat Esther in Light of Zechariah. So worst case scenario, it's good Purim Torah, which means it's not true, but it's like fun and interesting. I said worst case, or best case scenario, maybe worst case scenario, that it's serious and we're in big trouble. if God gave us another opportunity, but that's enough. No more Zionism for the night. Okay. How long story take? It begins in year 3 and ends in year 12. We did the years. In other words, for Ahasuerus to fit in the timeline, we need at least 14 years. And that's why it can't be Cambyses. But if we say Koresh was only king for 3 years, then you can just squeeze in the 18 years between Koresh and Daryavesh, but we spend a lot of time on that. But that's why if you don't study outside history, you can get away with the Midrashic interpretation of Seder Olam, but when you look at outside history, now, it could be this message is so deep and so hard that the rabbis had to hide it, like you call it like you hide your dirty laundry. the fact that we had an opportunity, we didn't listen to it. You don't want to proclaim, you know, proudly how bad we were. So it could be that the message is hidden. And because the Megillah hides the message that you're supposed to find, all the Midrashim hide the message as well. So don't be surprised that Chazal don't spill the beans, even though they might have understood it that way. But they follow the Megillah and they allude to everything. The Kelim Mikelim Shonim, Kelim in the Beit HaMikdash. Yirmiyahu, they're making the party. They bring Yirmiyahu 7 years into the party from a totally different angle. But they're doing the same thing, but they're including that hidden approach. Okay, I guess I have to stop because I know I promised give at least 10 minutes before Josh's class. So thank you so much, Rabbi.